So today's talk will go kind of from the abstract to the practical, from the perhaps sublime and religiously challenging to the most everyday, concrete, essential thing that we can do in Buddhism. So you have to kind of hang in there as we go from the abstract to the practical. And probably one of the most abstract places you could start in any religious tradition is to ask the question, on what authority, what's the authority upon which you have your religious beliefs? You know, you have these, you know, great religious, your great world religion, you're called a religion, and you teach these things that are supposed to be true. And how do you know that they're true? And then you go down the street to another meditation center or a church or synagogue or temple or something, and they say, you know, this is the way. And then you say, well, we have it on authority that it's this way, and they have it on authority that it's that way. And so who has the right authority? By what authority do religious beliefs come from? And some people claim that their religious beliefs come from great divine sources. So they have tremendous power and authority because of that claim. But then you can ask the question, upon what authority do you know that it came from that wonderful divine source? Well, you know, my minister told me. Well, how does she know? What authority does she have it? Oh, well, she went to seminary. People at seminary, you know, what authority do they have? Oh, you know, and they say, well, it came from this book. Well, what about that book? So you can kind of ask these questions. And I once heard of a professor of Christian religion who was a Christian. And he went over to a Buddhist scholar, a young budding Buddhist who was becoming a Buddhist scholar. And he said, don't go down that route, the scholarly route. If you go on the scholarly route, we start investigating and questioning the source of the authority of your beliefs. It's really hard. You know, it's really hard to kind of, your religious beliefs sometimes kind of end up feeling like they're on quicksand. So I'm sure this is not true for everyone in all religions, but certainly the issue of religious authority, what authority we have something, is certainly an interesting question to ask. And I suspect that a lot of people don't ask that question very often. In fact, a number of people have told me that when they went to Sunday school and they started asking questions like that, they were asked to please don't come back. So, the Buddha was wandering around India 2,500 years ago. And at his time, there were a lot of other religious teachers with very different religious teachings wandering around as well. And he came to a town belonged to the people called Kalamas. And he showed up, and the Kalamas went to the Buddha, and they were kind of very, very cleverly or very reasonably, they said, well, you're just another spiritual teacher coming to town. We have a lot of teachers coming to town. Now tell me, rather than telling us about what you have to say, why don't you tell us, how can we decide amongst them all who has the truth? That's a pretty good question, right? How can we find your way through all these? So then the Buddha makes a declarative statement, which you should always be a little bit suspicious of when religious people make declarative statements. That's what us religious people are good at, that. And that's supposed to carry certain authority. But so the Buddha makes a declarative statement. So now you've been warned that this is coming. So you can do with it what you wish. And this is this statement that I'm about to read is very famous, and it's often quoted, and it's often misquoted a lot. And it is loved by many people. And there's a Zen teacher who has taught here, a lovely teacher named Yvonne Rand, who said once that every Buddhist should have this statement tattooed on the inside of their eyelids. It's so important. so these Kalambas that come to the Buddha and they say they're perplexed by all these different teachers that come through, and how should they figure it out, decide amongst them. The Buddha says to them, "Of course you're uncertain. Of course you're in doubt. When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty is born. So in this case, Kalambas, don't go, don't decide, don't go by the authority of reports, by legends, by tradition, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering views, by probability, or by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher." What's left? Don't go to the authority of just reports, just because you hear about it, someone says it, by legends, by myths, by tradition. It's by tradition. It's always been my parents and parents before that. And back. Don't go by tradition. Don't go by scripture. That's a big one, right? I'm holding this Buddha scripture, right? And it's kind of self-destructs. Don't go by scripture. By logical conjecture. This is hard for some people. They think they can rely on their own logic and reasoning to come to the truth, religious truth. And here the Buddha says, don't go by your reasoning. That's kind of challenging. By probability, interesting one, Pascal's wager. And or the thought that this person is my teacher, therefore it must be true. So that's then it goes on. But as it goes on, it's often then misquoted in popular Western writing. And the misquote says something like, go by your own experience, or go by what you know yourself. So the point is to kind of focus on yourself and what you know for yourself. And popularly in California, people say, like, you know, go by your own truth, as if you somehow what you think you believe is true. And but this is what the Buddha said. When you know for yourselves that these qualities are helpful, these qualities are... when you know that these qualities are unhelpful, then these qualities are criticized by the wise. And when you know for yourself, when these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. It's an interesting statement, because what he's done is he's reframed the question. Rather than kind of going answering the question, how do you know what is true? He's actually suggesting, instead of that question, focus on how you know what is harmful and what is beneficial. Know what is helpful and what is not helpful. So it's a reframing. So, for example, if you have appendicitis, you want to know whether the doctor can help you or not. You don't want to know whether, you know, you might want to know, you know, what medical school the doctor came from, or just, you know, but there's a lot of things which are kind of incidental. So the Buddha once did this analogy where, you're not supposed to go by analogy, it says, but it's really, you know, once the statement just kind of leaves you with nothing. But the... there's a man who was struck by an arrow, and it had poison in the arrow and all that. And it was really important to get the arrow out quickly. And so people came, and said, no, don't take it out. Before you take it out, I need to know who shot the arrow, what kind of wood it was shot from. I need to know the caste background of the person who shot it. You know, goes through all this list of things that he needs to know. But the time it takes to investigate all those things, the poison will have done its work and the man will have died. So the same thing with spiritual things. We have this arrow of suffering. Somehow we hurt, we're in pain, we're afraid, we're angry. There's different kinds of suffering we have. And if you spend a lot of time trying to delve into getting the final resolution on the core issues of religious authority, what's really true? How do you really know? maybe it's like the man who's struck by the arrow, who doesn't take the arrow out until he has all the answers. You following? So here the Buddha is reframing the issue away from the issue of how do you know what's true, to suggesting instead focus on knowing what is beneficial and not beneficial, what is harmful and what is not harmful, and what brings suffering and what brings happiness. And that's something experiential. That's something you can supposedly know for yourself. You can know whether something brings you a greater sense of ease and well-being, or you can know whether it brings you a greater sense of depression or heaviness or suffering or despair or discouragement or something. Those are things you can feel and know for yourself. You don't need a scripture, a book, or a teacher to tell you you're feeling better. I hope you don't. So here the Buddha's pointing these people, the Kalamas, back to something that they can find in themselves. Some teachers will say that the ultimate scripture you find in your own heart. But the way you find it, the Buddha said, is not through your reasoning, not because some things agree with what you think, not because it sounds good or is good for your identity, but rather in a very simple experiential way, that is this harmful for me or is it beneficial for me? And a big part of the mindfulness practice involves becoming more and more sensitive so we can become our own teacher and find our way in this regard. Because if you're more and more sensitive, you'll also find that certain things which seem like they're beneficial for you on the surface are not really beneficial when you really get down deep inside. You might think it's beneficial for you to unwind watching television. I've watched television sometimes and felt lousier. I generally feel lousier after I watch it than before, even though I think I'm relaxing. Something very seductive about it. So that's maybe one example, maybe not true for everybody. The pursuit of wealth, the pursuit of all kinds of pursuits that on the surface, you know, like gossiping. Gossiping can feel good. You can bond with someone. It's kind of energy and excitement and thrill. But if you're really sensitive, you find that actually there's a kind of clutching or a kind of hostility that's causing you pain in yourself. But usually we override it. We don't see it because we're so focusing on the gossip and kind of the surface kind of good feeling that might come. So the part of mindfulness is to get really sensitive so we can really know what's truly helpful for us, what's truly beneficial, what's truly bringing us a sense of well-being. So that's what has authority in Buddhism. That's what they're suggesting in Buddhism is ultimately the Buddha does not have that authority, the scriptures don't have authority. They're meant to be helpful. The teaching are meant to be guides for us. But that is not where the authority resides. The authority resides in testing things out, finding out for oneself, trial and error, finding what is it that leads you to a greater sense of peace and well-being in this life. You have to rely on yourself to find this way. There has to be a way of taking responsibility for this. And then checking and counter-checking and testing the waters and finding out. And you can find your way. So one of the things this quote says is those qualities which are unhelpful or helpful and which are criticized or which are recommended by the wise. So it doesn't say, you know, in some kind of radical way, only rely on yourself. There is some encouragement to get advice from people who you think are wise. The wise people, what do they say is beneficial? What do they say is harmful? And then you have to find out for yourself whether that's true or not. But you have, at least you're kind of getting yourself into the territory. You're getting some good advice. So you find people who are wise. So that's the abstract part. Okay? So then, in this famous discourse, the Buddha is going to give the Kalamas an example of how to do this. And in this example, the example he uses is cultivating loving kindness. And it seems that the practice of loving kindness was known in India at the time of the Buddha. It's not necessarily a Buddhist practice. It seems to be known at the time. And it's generally taken this way, taken to be a meditation practice, where you sit down to meditate, and you cultivate on a cultivate by focusing on a sense of boundless love for all beings. It's a great thing to do. It's a nice thing to do. So you do this practice of boundless love. You sit down and kind of open your heart and reflect on your good wishes, your kindness, your care, your concern, your friendliness for all beings. And you kind of open up and let that kind of radiate from you as a kind of warmth almost in all directions. Then, the Buddha says, if you do that, then you'll find out for yourself whether this is beneficial or not for you. And you'll receive, I'll summarize it briefly. You'll receive two things. You'll notice two things if you do this. And now, in most English translations of this passage, they'll translate this as the assurances. You'll receive certain assurances if you do this. In one translation in English, translated as the word solaces. However, the original Pali maybe has that technical meaning of assurance, but the literal meaning, the literal words, means to breathe easy. To breathe easily. So if you do this, practice loving kindness, you'll receive the benefit of being able to breathe easily in this way. It's very different to talk about receiving assurance, like guarantees, versus attaining something that's very physical and immediate. You get to breathe easier. That's nice, isn't it? The first reason for breathing easily is, that is, if you've done the loving kindness practice, the first reason for breathing easily is, if there is a world after death, and if good and bad deeds bear fruit in the afterlife, then with this as the basis, with a loving kindness as a basis, I will be reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world. So there's a kind of reassurance then. There's a kind of assurance, oh yeah, you know, when I die, something good's going to happen. I'm not going to go to hell. So, but the word says you can breathe easily, which is nice, right? And the second assurance, the second reason for breathing easily is, if there is no world after death, okay? He's not saying there is or isn't one of these, but those are basically the two options, right? So you're kind of covering your bases. If there is no world after death, if good and bad deeds do not bear fruit in the afterlife, then in this life, you will live happily, free from hostility, ill will, and upset. So, if there is a rebirth, you can breathe easily because good things will occur to you. If there is not an afterlife, if this is the only life we have, then you can breathe easily because you will live happily. If you're filled with loving kindness, you live happily, free from hostility, ill will, and upset. Isn't that pretty good? Now, what I want to focus on here is this idea of breathing easily. He goes through this great statement about religious authority, changes the direction of the inquiry to focus on what is beneficial and what is harmful, what brings suffering, what brings happiness. And then he gives an example for this that focuses on something very concrete that you can experience and know for yourself, and that you can know whether you're breathing easily or not. Now, why would you want to breathe easily? Aren't there more important things to do? You know, there's things to accomplish. Breathing easily, when the breath is being breathed easily, we're at peace. We're at ease. We're happy. We're at ease. When the breath is not easy, when it's contracted or held in some kind of way, it generally represents some way in which our mind and heart is contracted and held. If we're afraid, the diaphragm sometimes gets pulled up and it's held tight. Or the stomach is pulled in and held. Or if you're angry, there might be a lot of tension in the chest someplace, or maybe also in the diaphragm or the belly. Or if you're depressed, there could be a feeling of heaviness weighing down on the chest. And every time you breathe in, you just can't breathe in all the way. You feel so oppressed, perhaps. Can't breathe in fully. How we feel is very closely tied to how we breathe. There's a very intimate relationship with how we feel and how we breathe. And if we take care of how we breathe and become the caretakers of our breathing, we then directly become the caretakers of how we feel. If you go about your day paying attention to your breathing, and you notice those times when your breathing is held or tight or constricted, and then if you relax it, you probably notice that your mood shifts with that relaxation. If you're able to cultivate a very relaxed breath, and for some people it takes a while, like through meditation and other things, to develop a very deeply relaxed breath where the muscles of the torso and diaphragm and the stomach are all relaxed, then the breath becomes a more and more sensitive instrument to notice the shifts in your mood and shift in what's going on in you. And sometimes it's easier to adjust or fix or find peace. It's easier to find peace by relaxing your breathing than it is to practicing psychoanalysis on yourself. What's this all about? What did my mother do to me? Why am I this way? Why am I so angry right now? Why am I so afraid? It's just, someone please explain to me. I'll pay someone a lot of money for this. And all you need to do, perhaps I'm kind of being a little bit ridiculous here, but all you need to do is just take a deep breath and relax. it's not always that easy. But the suggestion is that maybe sometimes it is that easy. Maybe sometimes you can bypass a lot of the kind of complicated ways in which we're kind of caught up in our life by taking a deep breath and relaxing. Easing your breath. And the more easeful your breath is, the more sensitive you'll be to the subtleties of what's going on in your heart and your mind. I find that mindfulness of breathing is, I call it the great lubricator. Because if you keep paying attention to your breath, it's hard to stay kind of locked up or frozen. On Saturday I called mindfulness of breath WD-40 for the mind. You know, just kind of oil that kind of oils the hinges. And now just come back to your breathing and discover what's going on with your breath. Take your breath very seriously. And have a habit, have a very powerful, almost like a habit, that whenever you can throughout the day, come back and check in what's going on with your breath. Just like I'm doing, even now when I'm talking to you, I'm constantly checking in with my breath. Is my breath relaxed? Am I pulling up my diaphragm? Am I worried about how well I'm getting my ideas across? And all the kind of any worry I might have, or any idea, I have to kind of really make a good point here, or really say this well. I can feel a change with the muscles of my rib cage and my diaphragm, my stomach, and sometimes my feel in my shoulders and even my back rib cage sometimes. And sometimes that's the first indication I have that something is a little bit amiss. And then I can kind of adjust it and kind of relax, let that go, let it fall down. To have a soft belly is another way of talking about this. Keep your belly soft. Some people are conditioned, were conditioned as maybe as young children even, that it was important to keep their belly pulled in. There was a certain period in America where women got that message, suck in your stomach. It's very unbecoming to have a stomach that hangs out. And some men also, maybe from different kind of reasons, have also been trained to hold their stomach in. Stomach in and chest out. And which kind of interferes with the breathing. not only is it inferior with the breathing, but it, because the breath, the breathing apparatus is held tense, it's hard for the inner emotional life to relax as fully as it can, because there's such a close relationship between how we hold our breath and how we hold our emotions. And I've known people who, when they finally released their stomach that was being held for years and years, the first thing that happened was they cried, because it was just held in there for so long, was locked in. And when they relaxed their belly, finally those tears could come out. Now, occasionally people will say, oh no, this is terrible. This is worse than before. I'm crying. But that usually passes after a while. And after a while they realize, that really needed to happen. I really needed to purge that and finally let it out. Sometimes it can be anger that finally gets released. Finally we relax certain things, certain holding, and we realize we have all this built up anger. And one of the great places in life to be angry, you know where it's really good to be angry? It's really good to be angry while you meditate. If you're going to be angry, do it in meditation. Let it rip. Because it's safe, right? You're not going to hurt anybody. And you can keep your eyes closed. You're committed to not moving. And then just let it go. Don't indulge it. Don't get involved in it. But if it's this release that's happening, finally relaxing, let something bubble, let it move through you. Just like you let tears move through you. So let it come. So sometimes there's a lot of stuff that gets released as we release the breathing. And so you have to kind of work through that period of time. You know, the word anxiety comes from the Greek word for choking. So, you know, again, this close connection between emotions and our breathing. You know? So, breathe easily. It's a really a simple thing. It doesn't sound like a great, fantastic religious ideal. You know, there's other religious ideals that seem much more grand and wonderful than your religious neighbors say, what's your religion based on? Oh, breathing easily. Oh, gee, I'm sorry for you. You know, I'm communing with the creator of the universe, and you're breathing easily. But the suggestion is that breathing easily is a very, very powerful vehicle. So powerful that some Buddhists will call it a vehicle to the divine. Not because it's, there's, you know, the same reasons as maybe theistic religions, but they hold it up as being a very powerful vehicle to a kind of peace and well-being and ease that is so sublime that it's one of the greatest things that can happen to you. It's the when the breath is at ease, when the diaphragm is relaxed and the belly is soft, the heart is soft, chest is soft, the shoulders are relaxed, then some of the very best qualities of who we are can flow through easily through us. The best qualities of love, of kindness, of integrity, of authenticity, of honesty, tends to flow through us the easiest. And to breathe easily will open doors of peace, which will serve you with tremendous happiness for a long time. And so you become the authority for whether you're breathing easily or not. You do not need a scripture. You do not need a teacher. You do not need legends and myths. You do not need your reasoning and logic to decide whether you're breathing easily or not. That's something you can find out for yourself. And then begin following the trail. Follow the track that leads you to breathing more and more easily throughout your day in all circumstances. And I will tell you that I believe that using breathing easily as your guide, your breath will become your best teacher. So, may you all breathe easily. Thank you.